This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Corey Johnson. We're here every day bringing you the latest news in the world of business and finance.
And the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 o'clock Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.
Fun weekend for investors, getting to hear from one of, if not the most respected investor of our time. And we're talking about Warren Buffett. He came out with his annual letter to shareholders and investors. Variety of topics. Let's get a roundup with Kat Chigalinsky. She is U.S. finance reporter at Bloomberg News on the Buffett beat, and she joins us in our Bloomberg 1130 studio. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the letter. Everybody looks forward to it. It's usually a pretty lengthy letter, and Warren Buffett talks about his investments and talks about a variety of things.
Totally. And this year, it was a little shorter than normal, so I think people, it kind of surprised people a bit. But I think the main gist we were getting from this newsletter, this letter is, you know, be patient. I think Buffett took us through kind of, you know, it was a hard year for his deal making. He called it a drought. And he said, you know, businesses were reaching all-time highs on prices. And with kind of the extraordinarily cheap debt available, it was just really hard for him to find some deals that would have made sense for Berkshire.
It's the best year in increase in book value, which is the number that he says is most important. Well, it's one of the numbers he says is most important. The best increase in book value this company, this giant company, has seen in 20 years with a 23% increase. Sorry, a 23% increase in book value, 22% interest in the stock price, which we already knew about. That's a remarkable year for a company this big. The kind of year that he said we wouldn't see anymore, and we keep seeing.
We have to think a little bit about tax reform. Part of that was driven by he got $29 billion benefit into his earnings because of tax reform.
That's a big benefit,
yes,
to say
quite,
the least.
Quite the sum.
It's interesting going into this, Kat, that last week you were saying, oh, maybe we'll hear about a successor and a few other things. What didn't he put in the newsletter that was noticeably missing?
I think we all want, you know, more hints about succession. He did praise Ajit Jain and Greg Abel in their new roles as vice chairman. And, that was great, but I don't think it really...
But he praises them every letter.
Yes. Jane, it didn't really give us
Jane in particular has gotten a lot of praise over the years.
Totally. So it was just kind of, it was lacking in terms of like any more news about what their new roles actually entail and mean for the future of Berkshire.
What about in terms of the healthcare triumvirate, if you will, between J.P. Morgan, Warren Buffett, and Jeff Bezos of Amazon?
He actually steered clear of that in the whole letter, which I think was a little shocking, too. But he talked about it this morning, and he mentioned...
He's been doing interviews, correct?
Definitely. He's been doing interviews, and he mentioned in one of them that, it's a problem he really wants to tackle. I mean, it's hugely expensive, and they're looking to do more than just sort of shave off 3%, 4% in cost, you know, because you can get that through some negotiating power, he said. And I think it was an interesting reminder of they're really going for it with this.
They're along a lot of tax-sensitive, well, housing-related companies, right, with Clayton Homes and PFJ and other companies that need people to be willing to buy homes, particularly in a low end with the mobile home stuff. Any sense of what that business means to them with tax reform changing the way people can expense their payments for such homes?
Those businesses did pretty well in the fourth quarter. It'll be interesting, to see how it actually plays out. Again, a lot of those businesses are driven by kind of the broader economy, how, you know, that's feeling. He's still bullish on that. He said, I think the American economic soil remains fertile. So I think he still has an optimistic look.
What about technology? What did he say? Because, right, we've seen Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway, and those who work for him, they've been moving into some more of those big tech names, including things like Apple.
He talked today a little bit about it. Apple has been one of his biggest purchases over the past year.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because you're going from IBM, kind of this old school kind of technology giant. He said, you know, that was kind of a mistake that he made. And now he's going into Apple. It's interesting whether it's, you know, fully a Buffett kind of move or, you know, how much his deputies are kind of playing into that.
Berkshire is the fourth largest shareholder.
And it's second,
Apple.
And Wells Fargo is only the only other holding it has. It's bigger, right? Only slightly bigger.
Actually, by market value now, it might be a little bit
more Apple.
Yeah,
$169 million.
Yeah.
Right? That's what it looks like.
In the letter, it said it was a $28 billion holding, and in the letter, it said that Wells Fargo was a $29 billion.
Oh, I'm sorry, 169 million shares.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, but the price is adjusted. I put out a tweet. You can fact check me if maybe you don't know what I mean to stump the band. That in his IBM holding, that he actually made money in that holding. That at least according to data on the Bloomberg Terminal, that he may have made money in that holding, an 8% profit in IBM, even though earnings fell 64%. During the time that he held the stock. Imagine a company whose earnings go down, I'm referring to net income, not earnings per share. I know IBM will be calling me in a second. The net income, which is the actual profit of the company, declined 64% during Buffett's time holding, and it was still up 8%.
I mean, he's, you know, it worked out. I don't think it was the worst, you know, kind of mistake he made, and it worked out for him. Now he's just kind of he holds $2 million shares of IBM, so mm-hmm. It's kind of now on the back burner for...
He also, in his interviews this morning, right, talked a little bit about Teva, right, the generic pharmaceutical maker, which has not had a good couple of years and going through lots of changes and trying to figure things out, but they owned it.
Yeah, they took a stake in the fourth quarter, according to some regulatory
filings. They own
filings.
It, right?
Yeah, and what was interesting this morning, though, is Buffett said, "Hey, that wasn't me." He, you know, it's important to remember there's three guys at least at Berkshire picking stocks. It's him, Todd Combs, and Ted Weschler. So it's kind of interesting. We don't know which of the other two might have been doing it, or if it was both of them. But that'll be something to keep an eye out for.
I love that. Hey, it wasn't me.
Yeah, options. They've had some derivative contracts that seem to go against everything that Warren Buffett says he believes in. But he's writing some options because he thinks that that other people's bets are stupid. What do we know? What's the update there?
Those are actually declining. So he's starting to kind of wind some of those down, which is interesting. In the letter, though, I'm always fascinated by his comments on equities versus bonds. He was very pro-equity and railed against bonds and how it's so hard to make a return and you shouldn't really think that they're risk-free.
But he wasn't as upbeat as he has been, like, buy America, right? We didn't see that necessarily in the tone.
Yeah, well, because he steered clear about a lot of these issues. We didn't hear much about politics. We didn't hear much. We heard a couple comments about kind of the economy, but on the rest of it, it was kind of silent.
Always good, though, to hear what he has to say and check in. Kat, thank you. Appreciate it. Kat Jagielinski, she is U.S. finance reporter at Bloomberg News. You can check her out on Twitter, and you can check her out at Bloomberg.com, joining us in our Bloomberg 1130 studio.
You should play that for every guest, don't you think? It's perfect for a business show. Well, as we look at these markets and the cost of stocks in particular in these markets right now, it's a concern for a lot of investors trying to figure out where value exists because of the prices you pay. What do they say? Value is what you get, the price is what you pay.
I like that.
No, Abe Desponde joins us right now, the founder, CIO at Centerstone Investors, right here in 1130 Studios in New York. Good to see you. Welcome.
Thanks, Corey.
This market, you know, Warren Buffett is always a buyer, so he's always complaining about prices, except after things get really ugly. What are you seeing, and where are you seeing it?
Well, you know, there's that, I don't know if you remember or not, but stocks went down a couple of days ago.
We do remember.
And it was fun while it lasted. We were able to put a little bit of our cash to work. But it's been, as you can imagine, I mean, the 10% decline, all it really did was take us back 1 month, right? So nothing really changed with that correction.
You put some money to
work. We did.
A little bit?
A little bit. 1%, maybe 1.5%.
Okay.
And we have a lot of cash. We're sitting on roughly 25%.
So why not more?
Just not enough happened. We're value investors at Centerstone, and we do take a long-term view of things. And so our primary objective is to absolute returns over market cycle, and also to avoid the permanent loss of capital. So we're really focused on risk management first and foremost. And so, you know, some value did emerge, particularly in very interest rate sensitive names. And we did take some take some cash and put it to work.
Like what?
I can't give you specific names.
Oh, come on. Yes, you can.
Okay.
Unless you won't, well, maybe, but you can.
I can do this interview in jail next time if you want me to. But,
okay.
No, it's not illegal. It's a full disclosure medium. You can tell us whatever you want to. You can choose not to, but it's not illegal to actually tell us what's going on. Okay, so among the stocks you guys have liked, though, O'Reilly. You love O'Reilly Automotive. You guys loved that in the past.
We do. Yeah, it's a relatively new holding for us. We bought last summer. There were several companies that got hit while Amazon, you know, basically due to this Amazon threat. You remember, of course, the Whole Foods kind of thing and how it affected grocery stores. But, you know, it's like a steamroller. They went through different parts of the economy, announced entry into, like I said, groceries, but also industrial parts distribution, In the case of O'Reilly Auto Parts, you know, retail, some of these businesses are very well insulated from sort of the threat of an Amazon type company. And O'Reilly, we find, is one of those. It has a very strong market position with its core customer base, which is really mechanics and garages. Now, they can deliver auto parts to the garage within an hour. It's really difficult for any business to compete against that, much less an Amazon, which mm-hmm. really does maybe at the best, you know, next day delivery. So they're very well positioned. I think that there's plenty of upside potential for O'Reilly
stock
in the long term.
Early last year, went from like 250 down to 180. Starts to look more attractive then because revenues actually were going up.
Yeah, revenues were going up. Cash flows have been solid. They've been returning cash flow to us shareholders.
So free cash flow, an important metric for you.
Free cash flow is important, but what they do with the cash flow is also important. So do they, you know, waste it on frivolous acquisitions or options plans or what have you? Or do they invest, and do they have the opportunity to invest it?
So a company like a Cisco that, in fact, actually has a lot of free cash flow but spends it buying back the shares they issue to buy companies is less interesting.
You mean Cisco Systems?
Systems.
Yeah. It's less interesting, although I have owned that in the past. I mean, there are moments when those businesses, you know, price can sometimes overcome the negative.
The mechanics
parts
of free cash flow,
If Amazon, though, did enter into the automotive sector in a big way, how does that change the O'Reilly investment picture?
Well, they're already there. I mean, you know, you can get when you go to O'Reilly, I mean, sometimes you also buy it like air freshener or a battery or what have you. A lot of that stuff can be delivered to your home. You don't need to go to O'Reilly for that. For the, you know, I mentioned half the business is the mechanics. The other half is it's people who like to work on their cars and where the car is off warranty and they can't afford to. You know, or maybe they're more price conscious or just enjoy working on their cars.
Right.
But then you're talking about, you know, not just oil filters, but maybe parts of the oil system, the you know, not just a spark plug, but maybe like a radiator,
right.
Things like that. Very difficult to just overnight that to somebody. At O'Reilly, also, when you come there with a problem, they have trained people that can help you identify what the problem is and sell you the right part.
I mean, I was trying to teach my daughters how to work the hardware store. I say, here's what you do. You come in, you talk to one of these guys in these red vests, and you say, I need one of those things you stick in the back of the thing. It kind of makes the toilet stop making that thing sound.
Yeah.
And you need those people. You can't do that on Amazon.
No, you can't. The AI has not progressed so far as to decipher what teenagers say, or think.
We're running out of time, and I know you had a couple other names, but maybe you'll have to come back and talk to us about them in the future.
That'd be my pleasure. Yeah,
interesting. Not worried about the environment, though? Or do you think things are going to get cheaper again?
You know, we are operating
just quickly.
Mantra is basically just assume something is going to go wrong. And that's why we have cash. That's why we're not always, quote unquote, worried, but we're always ready.
All right. Good to check in with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron.
Abhay Deshpande. He is founder, chief investment officer at Centerstone Investors in our Bloomberg 1130 studio right here in New York City.
Oh, I love trash.
We did it.
I guessed it right.
I love it, Oscar, from Sesame Street. Coventa, though, is a company working with other companies and communities to find sustainable solutions to waste management. Let's talk about the business. Steve Jones is president and CEO at the waste energy plant operator Coventa Holding Corporation, based in Morristown, New Jersey, in our Bloomberg 1130 studio on this Monday. Welcome to Bloomberg Radio.
Thank you, Carol. I appreciate it.
Tell us exactly what you guys do.
So we're the world's leader in energy from waste. So we operate about 40 plants around the
energy
world.
Energy from waste.
Energy from waste, right. So we take in waste from a number of different sources, primarily from residential waste, process 20 million tons a year, produce renewable power, and we also reclaim a lot of metal, which we can talk about. It's fascinating how much metal comes through the waste stream.
Is all waste, or can all waste be converted into energy in a profitable way?
Yes. There's some waste that you don't want to take through an energy from waste plant. Because
nuclear?
You want to be environmental, well, nuclear waste, right? So there's certain types of waste that, from an environmental standpoint, you don't want to take through that combustion process.
Right.
But most waste can go through the combustion process. And think about this. There's a lot of energy that went into making all the things that we then throw away. And so reclaiming the British thermal units, so the BTUs from that waste, is a better alternative than taking that waste, burying it into the surface of the earth. It decomposes over the next 50 to 100 years. It produces methane. Methane's about 30 times worse than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. And so the view of a lot of countries, not so much the U.S., but a lot of countries, is that it's better to take that that waste, reclaim the BTUs rather than putting it in the earth and having the methane gas be produced.
And here, what's the different approach?
So it's interesting. In the U.S., a number of these plants were built back in the 80s to mid-90s. But the U.S. is blessed with two things that impact new energy from waste plants here in the U.S. The first is we have a lot of land. And so countries that have smaller footprints, and think about any island nations, will more quickly get to the point where they want to use their land for things other than landfills. And then secondly, you have to pay for the capital in these plants. And one of the revenue streams is power. And so we're blessed by a lot of natural gas here in the U.S. And so our power prices are low. So if you think about the we get paid for three streams associated with these plants. We get paid for the waste that we take in, mm-hmm. the renewable power that we produce, and the metals. So some combination of those three revenue streams need to be robust enough in order to pay for the capital associated
so
with
how
these plants.
So how quickly does a plant pay for itself then?
About 8 years.
Okay.
If you look, we just built a new plant in Dublin, Ireland. The returns on a plant like that will be mid-teens, so good returns. If you look at rates of return, internal rates of return around the world, that plant costs about 500 million euros, so these are expensive plants. But if you look out over, 10 years or so, you'll be able to
return. It's after 10 years, and that's your cost of capital, but that's not so bad.
Yeah.
So we tease this by saying, we're going to talk about, Carol wasn't in the room when I did it, but I said many people accuse liberals of looking at the Trump administration and saying it's garbage. We're going to talk about garbage under the Trump administration.
There you go.
How has this regulatory environment affected your business?
It's interesting. I got a question about this recently. Whether it was President Obama or President Trump, it really hasn't impacted our business to a great extent. A lot of these decisions are made at the municipal level.
Mm-hmm.
And these are critical infrastructure projects, but most of these types of projects, just like wastewater treatment or providing water to people is made at a more local level. And so,
there's less money, let's see if there's less money coming from the federal government for whatever projects, and if municipalities and states, could certainly impact
as
you
municipalities,
guys.
Municipalities lose some funding, that could have an impact. But the one thing you see in a lot of cases is that these municipalities are starting to look out longer term now to figure out what their waste strategy is going to be. So if you look at places like Long Beach Island.
Long Beach Island in New Jersey, off the coast.
Yeah. If you
beautiful vacation spot.
Yeah, nice place.
Sandy beaches, warm water.
Yeah, and you look at these places.
No, you're talking about Ireland, aren't you?
No, I'm talking about the U.S. Yeah.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah, I'll talk about Ireland in a second. But if you look at places like Honolulu, for example, places where it's difficult to get rid of the waste, they'll more quickly go to energy from waste as the preferred way to dispose waste in these communities.
Now, you guys cite the Federal Power Act as being important to your business and exemptions under the Federal Power Act that you received. Explain to me what that is and how you think it might change in the Trump administration.
This business really is driven not so much by the Federal Power Act. There's opportunities as regulations change to get more for the power that we produce. It's really driven, most of our business is driven by the waste industry. And in the U.S., it's a great time to be a waste company. If you talk with Waste Management or Waste Connections, waste pricing, particularly in the Northeast, is getting tighter as more and more landfills are shutting down. And that tends to be, now let's pivot to Ireland. One of the opportunities we had in Ireland was the Irish were running out of landfills, and mm-hmm. so they were starting to have to export their waste to the European continent. And a lot of countries like to take care of their own waste. And the facility we just brought on stream in Ireland in October, now that it's on stream, takes about 40% of the waste in all of Ireland.
Well, I just want to follow up with what I said before about the Federal Power, because in your 10-K, you guys say, if you lose existing exemptions in the Federal Power Act, the economics and operations of our projects could be adversely affected. Is that not the case? Or
That'll have some impact on our business. But two-thirds of our revenues come from the waste side of our business.
Right.
Back in the day, when these plants were built, two-thirds of revenues came from the power side of the business.
So it really has changed.
It has changed a lot over the last 10, 15 years.
How much, Steve, too, is part of kind of this ESG wave, environmental social governance, and you also have people, well-known investors saying, I want to look at what these companies are doing. How is that maybe benefiting you? Just got about 30 seconds.
That benefits us a lot. If you look at waste and folks that are looking for companies that are looking for points from the Dow Jones Sustainability Index. Those types of companies and those types of investors realize that the disposal of energy from waste is a lot more sustainable than utilizing a landfill.
One thing we didn't get to ask you, and I got to ask you to be quick, your stock was under pressure, mm-hmm. earnings miss. What can you tell investors?
Actually, it wasn't an earnings miss. It was some concern about our
Earnings below consensus.
Free cash flow generation. And one of the things I've told investors is that we set our free cash, we set our dividend policy so that it's sustainable over the long term. And we signed a deal last year that gives us visibility into free cash flow out over the next several years,
okay.
where we basically are doubling free cash flow.
Steve Jones, President and CEO of Covanta Holding on Bloomberg. I'm fascinated by this story. Xi Jinping's decision to cast aside China's presidential term limits is stoking concerns. He also intends to shun international rules on trade and finance, even as he champions them on the world stage. Let's try and make some sense of this. Max Baucus is back with us, former U.S. senator, former U.S. ambassador to China under President Obama, also former Democratic senator, as I mentioned, from the state of Montana. He joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Ambassador, nice to have you back with us. I read this morning and I thought, this is pretty interesting and I think pretty significant. Tell me your assessment of it.
Well, Carol, it is significant, although we saw this coming. He is slowly amassing power. He is using the anti-corruption campaign to purge potential opponents and somebody that might challenge him. Although I might say that the people in China are very happy with his anti-corruption campaign because the people know there's a lot of corruption in the country. He put in the Constitution a little while back his thought, it's Xi thought, which in effect made him the main man in China. And so that eliminating the term limit here is a bit redundant, but it does solidify his position. But he's obviously in the man in China, and it enables him and the country to move, in their judgment, even more quickly to become a major political, military, and economic power.
Well, I had a well-known Wall Street investor, I had dinner with him about 2 years ago, and he said, watch this guy. This guy wants to be Mao. Does he want to be Mao Zedong?
Well, I think he does in the sense that he wants to be the leader, and that's already happened. The terms ascribed to him are much more significant than they are to his predecessors, Jiang Zemin or Hu Jintao, or even Deng Xiaoping. He's called in China now as the great leader, as was Mao. I think that's really what he wants to be. But more important, he wants to enshrine communist socialism in the system in China, as well as help lead China into this new era, the China dream, where China is ascending quite quickly.
Right. So what does this mean on a foreign stage, on a global stage, by him doing this? Because, it's great that he's cracking down on corruption. People see that. But he's also cracking down on, less access to the internet, really kind of controlling the message for the domestic homeland.
That's right. He's using two major tools to keep the people under control, if you will. One is to keep them happy. That is, help boost incomes, address air and water pollution, food safety, health care, and so forth. Help people achieve the quality of life that they want. But second, he is cracking down on civil society, on individual freedoms, so that there's more control. It's a very controlling country. So much now is surveilled. I mean, there are virtually cameras on most every corner in Beijing, and with soon facial recognition. So on the one hand, he's trying to keep people happy with jobs. On the other hand, he's trying to control them.
Well, it's interesting, too. One of the other fascinating stories I found that I thought last week about China buying into Daimler-Benz. Like, it's just kind of interesting, right? Embrace capitalism to a certain extent, particularly if it'll help the home market or help them control an industry, right? Because they're Made in China 2025, the One Belt, One Road initiative. They're really doing things to become this incredible economic powerhouse and platform, more so than even that they are today.
Well, I think that's the goal, no question. They're buying technologies they think help propel them in the future. Daimler-Benz, you know, maybe electrical vehicle technology that they maybe even produced in China. There's no question. And that's just one example. It really means that we in the West have to first recognize that, understand what they're doing.
Do we?
And second,
do we?
I don't know, but I it gets to my second point, which is once we tend to understand what's going on, we've got to figure out how we handle it. What do we do about it? I think this is the major challenge that our country is going to be facing in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. That is the China-U.S. relationship.
Are we laying the groundwork that's going to set us in the right policy direction, whatever that might be, in terms of dealing with China?
Well, it's up to us. You know, it's that old Bobo cartoon. If that's the enemy, he is us. Are we going to do what we need to do? And it's I hope so, but we have to work at it, those of us who care. And those of us who care have to help explain what we think is going on, at least start the discussion at a much deeper level than it's been thus far.
Do you think that our current government is doing that or ready to do that? I mean, China certainly has been a focus of President Trump.
No, I don't think we have, to be honest. I think our country really has not had a coherent, comprehensive China policy. We have in the past with respect to Russia, maybe even Iran, but not with respect to China. I think we Americans are a bit buffaloed by China. It's way over there, several thousand miles away, or more than 1,000 miles away, different culture, long, you know, all that, and it's just, and we don't know quite what to do about China. China is going very fast. You know, frankly, I care a lot about the relationship. We all do at U.S.-China. I want it to work. I want the gears to mesh, not to grind. This is not a zero-sum game where it's the United States wins, China loses, or China wins, U.S. loses. It should be an approach where we're working together. But that means we're going to have to stand up and say no to China,
right,
where it's appropriate, because I tell you, otherwise, China's going to keep going until they're checked either externally or internally, and it's up to us to do something about that.
All right, we got to run. Thank you so much. Former U.S. Senator and U.S. Ambassador to China, Max Baucus, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I feel the earth move under my feet.
You move like they do. I've never seen anyone move that fast.
All right, people, let's move like we've got a purpose.
Something's called movers and shakers. They cost a little more, but that name cracked me up.
Bloomberg Markets, Movers and Shakers, with Carol Masser and Corey Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, time for your Movers and Shakers on this Monday afternoon. I'm Carol Masser, along with Corey Johnson, both of us in our Bloomberg 1130 studio. Checking out the S&P 500, 383 names in the index are higher today, 118 lower, 4 unchanged. I thought I'd take a look at Teva Pharmaceutical, because we know Warren Buffett had some thoughts or some comments on that. He said, said he wasn't personally involved in the firm's decision to buy a stake in Teva. It's kind of funny. I didn't do it. It's like growing up, I had six brothers and sisters be like, I didn't do it.
I didn't break it.
Shares of Teva are down 2/10.
He's the one who breaks it.
Exactly. We would be like, who did it? And we'd be like, the who guy. Who did it? Who did it?
I've seen that in play.
Down 0.2% today at $20 a share. Shares of Teva are, what are they doing? They're actually up about 5.5% so far this year. But nonetheless, Warren Buffett saying the investment by Berkshire Hathaway in Teva was not his idea.
In the wake of the volatility, a blow up of the first week of February, or you know, the first full week of February.
Yeah.
Stocks melted down. Volatility, of course, as we know, went through the roof. The XIV collapsed in a financial disaster, the 95% loss for most holders. And then you had the S&P was down quite a bit. If you bought on the 9th, however, on that Friday, bought the S&P 500, you'd be up 6%. But if you bought Berkshire Hathaway on that day, you'd be up 12% right now, based on the positive results that they put up for the quarter, and as announced, and in the guidance that they gave and the commentary. Of course, it is one of the great joys of these financial markets is that commentary from Warren Buffett. So, from the very lows, there a big move even from the close on the 9th, an 8% move in that in shares of Berkshire Hathaway. So Berkshire Hathaway, one of the stories, one of the best read stories on the Bloomberg Terminal today is a look at those results. And shares of Berkshire Hathaway today up 4%.
And Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett, he's been out, you know, making some interviews, giving some interviews following that investor letter over the weekend. And he apparently made some comments to a competitor saying he was, quote, staggered by the size of the charge.
A competitor of Warren Buffett's?
No. A competitor of ours. Warren Buffett said, there's nobody who can compete with Warren Buffett. I'm just thinking. Anyway, Warren Buffett said he was, quote, staggered by the size of the charge General Electric took earlier this year tied to an old insurance portfolio. Having said that, check out shares of GE. At their low today, they were down, Corey, 3.7% at their high, and they're just off their highs now. They're up as much as 1.3%. Right now, the stock is up 1.1%, up 16 cents to $14.65 a share. Earlier, though, shares of GE were plunging as investors spurned CEO John Flannery's latest charm offensive, as we write here at Bloomberg. The CEO's letter to shareholders and a board overhaul announced on Monday failed to soothe concerns about looming liabilities on GE's balance sheet, which the company detailed in its annual report after markets closed on Friday. In its latest potential hurdle, GE warning it risks new penalties as the U.S. Department of Justice continues an investigation of the company's defunct subprime mortgage lender. So some investigations there. Anyway, right now shares of GE up 1.1%.
What did your daughter drink this morning before she went to school?
Apple cider. Organic apple cider.
She did not have milk.
No, but that's her other drink of choice.
Because she's one of many who didn't have milk this morning, though.
Shares, I had milk last night.
Milk, U.S. dairy milk consumption is in a long-term decline here. And it has hurt, of course, the largest U.S. dairy company, which the name of which is Dean Foods. Dean Foods shares down 13% on the day to close at $8.81. As a result of this, a big volume, sales volume down 6%. They're going to try to cut $150 million in expenses over the course of the next 2 years, including the consolidation of manufacturing capacity and the creation of a leaner organization structure. Milk puns. They said leaner, not me. But the decline in the consumption of milk is really hurting a lot of businesses, not least of which Dean Foods. And Dean Foods shares, as I mentioned, down 13% today. Volume through the roof. Stock is now at a 52-week low. It was as high as in April of last year. Shares are trading at $20, above $20. Now it's just above $8.
2% lactose-free organic.
It was down more than 2%.
Drinks of choice.
That's what I should have led with. I should have said, shares of Dean Foods are down more than 2%.
Lactose-free organic. All right, let's get to the volatility index report, the VIX. It is down 3.4%. The VIX closing today at 15.91. This is Bloomberg.
All right, Dave, you're up.
Hi, my name is Dave.
Wilson, where are you? Wilson!
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
We're going for a price on Wilson.
Open up the door, it's Dave!
Who?
Dave!
Hey, Mr. Wilson!
Dave Wilson joins us right now. Look at his stock of the day.
And that would be Chatham Lodging Trust. This is a company that owns hotels in a number of chains, Courtyard, Hilton, Residence Inn. There are plenty more where those three came from. They operate in the eastern half of the U.S., from Massachusetts to Texas. Their shares have been publicly traded since 2010. The ticker is CLDT. Chatham went public at $20 a share, plunged as much as 56% within its first 18 months of trading. While the stock later rebounded, it struggled to stay above its initial price. And today, Chatham Lodging fell back below it, thanks to disappointment with its latest results and outlook. In the fourth quarter, a cash flow gauge known as funds from operations, key for real estate investment trusts, trailed the average analyst estimate in a Bloomberg survey. The miss was the first in six quarters. The company's forecast for this year's revenue, earnings, and cash flow all came up short of projections as well. All this led to the biggest one-day drop in Chatham's shares since November 2011. They fell 8.4% on the day.
What's that ticker?
CLDT.
CLDT.
And that cash flow from operations isn't free cash flow, but it's how well the business is throwing off cash. You can mess with it for one quarter, but over the long term, you certainly can't.
Absolutely. Dave, it's a basis for figuring out dividend payments, among other things.
Dave, great stuff. Dave Wilson, as always, our stock editor. Keep an eye on some stocks we might have missed. Otherwise, grateful for that. You listen to Bloomberg Markets on Bloomberg Radio. This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays, 2 o'clock Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio. And follow us on Twitter. She's @CarolMasser, and I'm @CoreyTV.